Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Welcome to our conference call with Rabbi Willig, Rabbi Shlita, and we are now ready to begin. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Question number one. We have a social hall that we rent out for parties. Should we restrict the type of music played by the DJs? Should we require a mechitza if they will be dancing? Excellent question. Ideally, those who rent out the social hall should abide by the custom of the shul when they make their own parties. And if in the shul they make parties with proper music and if a mechitza for dancing, in an ideal world, the renters should be noe kuchumri hamokam shahokul l'sham and should follow the custom of the shul itself. That's in an ideal world. And if they won't, so just don't rent it out to them. And there could be situations in which that is not so viable, either because the shul needs the income, or because if the shul turns them down, there will be worse consequences. That's a judgment call for the Rav to make, every rabbi in his own shul. I would say that in a shas hatzchak, a difficult situation, you say to the, make a policy, look, we're only renting out a space, and the person who's renting out has different customs than we have. We're not responsible for the fact that their customs are different than our own. Let's remember that as objectionable as DJ music may be, and I think it's very objectionable, and I see it in many places with very orthodox people. I don't understand how they allow it, but it's a reality in a good part of the world that we inhabit, including what might be considered some of the more Haredi precincts where you hear this DJ type of music, not good Jewish music. Therefore, even though the shul itself and the Rav himself would never allow it in a shul function, he's probably seen it at other functions, and I don't think we have to draw the line and say it's completely impossible if there are other competing considerations. Those who were the mechitza, when I grew up, they had weddings, there were no mechitzas. My wedding had no mechitza. They danced without a mechitza, and they hoped that the people will only look at what they're supposed to look at. Truth is, even with the mechitza, as we all know, there were people looking through the mechitza, on the side of the mechitza. But once again, even though the shul's policy is to have a mechitza when there are men and women dancing, it's not something which they have to stand on principle and completely disallow it. On the other hand, if something is a much more serious prohibition, I think the shul should not allow it at all, even though the consequences may be worse. For example, if they want to mix dancing, that also used to exist, or they want to have Chil Shabbos, also used to exist in some places. I think that in our world, that should not be allowed at all. Even if the consequences will be worse, they'll eat not kosher food or something like that. Doesn't matter. She'll have to draw a line there. Obviously, if they want to bring non-kosher food into the shul, that's out of the question. Could be issues about levels of Ashgacha, which would be similar, but that's not part of the actual question. Number two, a middle-aged couple is discussing getting married for the second time. Each have children from a previous marriage. The husband is insisting that in their legal prenuptial agreement it be written, that if the husband passes away first, his wife can live in his home up to 1 year after he passes and then must leave the home so it can be given to his children. In general, what is the husband's responsibility to his almana? In this case, to his children, as his yorshim take precedence over his almana. Do the children of this husband have any responsibility to their father's almana? All good questions. By strict halacha, the Mishnah Masechta Ksuba, Nun Beis and Mid Beis, it's written as one of the Tanai Ksuba, that a widow can live in her late husband's home as long as she remains a widow. She remarries, and she forfeits that right. And that would be the default. On the other hand, Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Samech Tes Siv Beis, where this halacha is quoted, in Sivav, it says that if you make a tonight, the condition is valid. So therefore, if they have a prenup that has in it explicitly, the understanding is this, after we hear that the woman has to leave, so that's what the strict halacha is. And the Yorshim have precedence after the year, not before the year. It's not found anywhere in Shulchan Aruch. It's found in the condition. It was made in the prenuptial agreement. And their responsibility is therefore by definition limited to what the original agreement was. Should they go beyond their absolute responsibility in terms of helping out an almana? Well, that's a general mitzvah, help out an almana. And if you ask me, even though the father had written this in the prenup, after 1 year, technically speaking, they can take reclaim the house and she's left with nowhere to go, I don't think it should be done. But from the purely technical perspective, that's what was written, and she agreed to it, and they both signed it. That is the halach. Number three, BH, my office employs many from Jews. They allow us to daven mincha and ma'ariv without deducting it from our work time. Should an effort be made to daven as fast as possible, such as Hayecha Kedusha, only waiting for six people to say Kaddish after Shmon Esrei instead of 10, or since they are giving us time to daven, the understanding is to do it in the Lechatchila way. Now, my belief is that they have in mind to give it in the Lechatchila way, and therefore they should have a full Shmon Esrei at Mincha. However, waiting for 10 is not everyone agrees that it's even required. For a Kaddish after Maariv, they're even more making. And even for Chazara Tashat after Mincha, there are many who are Mekel, and there are many shuls where they are Mekel, not in places of work where you have to worry about the employer's dollar. But even in shuls, the people come together, known as Tircha de Tzibura. The Machlekes discussed at length contemporary discussion we found in the Sefer Piskei Tshuvos, speaks about it in two places, in Siman Kuf Chav Dalet Ostes, respect to Chazaras Hashat, and in Siman Nun Gimel, Os Yud Gimel, where he talks about it one more time. He implies that the Machlekes and the various Lechatchilas, I don't think we have to be more firm in the office than we are in the shuls. So if the people in their respective shul, they're all very careful to wait for 10 for either Kaddish or Chazaras Hashatz, that's included in their lechachil. But if in their respective shuls, they're not so careful, I mean, it may not be common, depending on where the shul is, if it's how many people are in the shul, is a big shul, a small shul, but if they are coming from shuls where on occasion the practice of Shem Tircha de Tzibura is to start the Kaddish or even start the Chazaras Hashatz without 10, and there is basis for it, then they don't have to be more strict than that on the employer's time. On that topic, an individual who sees that they're waiting for him, he's the number 10 guy, and there are 9 Jews who are very impatient, and he's just holding them all up, because that's their custom, and he should not be doing that. If you look carefully there in the Piskei Tshuvos, he quotes very stringent opinions against such individuals. He said he should wait long enough for the person to be able to say every word without extra cover. How long is that? He quotes, some will say, it's 9 minutes for Shmon Esrei. That's a long time. But twice as long as I think it takes to say the words. Perhaps you can say words even with some kavana in 6 minutes. We once spoke about that in the previous conference call. The Shia 6 minutes is based upon a Rambam, Hilchos Kriyas Shma, the Shia of Isur Shah, the correct text in Birchas Kriyas Shma. And we once counted the words. They were very comparable to the words of Shmon Esrei. So even that, even six is long for many shuls. Nine is maybe for yeshivas. The bottom line is that time is given for appropriate tefillah d'chatchila, and how that's defined specifically, both in terms of the timing and in terms of the waiting for 10 people, depends upon the custom of the individuals who are gathered for this minyan. But I think that a full Chadarat HaShatz is these days considered to be standard in just about all shuls. Next question. I daven Marav in an office where a Sefer Torah is kept in a closet wrapped up in a talus. It is stored there for a summer camp. The closet is on the south wall. Should be daven facing east or facing the closet where the Sefer Torah is kept? Question implies that the Sefer Torah is not visible at all. Probably most people don't even know it's there. And if it does not have a status of a heichal, what we call in our Kodesh, a heichal that you're supposed to face, according to most poskim, la maisa, even if it's in a different direction. And therefore, in this case, I would say they should face east toward Eretz Yisrael, even though the Sefer Torah is in the south. Now, there are those who would require that even in the case of a full-fledged Aron Kodesh. If you look it up in Mishnah Berurah, you'll see a discussion about it. It seems a contradiction between two places. It's likely that there's a Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos and Brachos. Not going into that discussion now. There will be another extra tziruf to face toward Eretz Yisrael in this particular case. Question 5. ABC Company, a balabas in a shul, is a retailer and has been doing business with XYZ Company, a wholesaler supplier, for years. ABC pays many of his bills to XYZ with third-party checks, meaning when Mr. Schwartz, a customer, purchases from ABC, he writes a check made out to cash. ABC gives XYZ check made out to cash as payment for his wholesale bill. As explained to me, this is the way people pay in this industry and wholesalers accept it. It is also understood that if a check deposited by XYZ bounces, ABC must make good on it, including all bank fees. Recently, XYZ's bookkeeper notified ABC that three separate checks totaling $1,800 and given to them by ABC nearly 2 years ago were not deposited by XYZ by mistake. Since a bank will not accept checks for deposit past 1 year, they want ABC to issue new checks totaling $1,800 and let ABC chase after their retail customers for repayment. ABC Company is reluctant to chase after the customers because, A, it was not their mistake, and B, they feel it's not professional and will make them look bad because they feel people will talk about their incompetence, and C, locating these three retail customers is time-consuming and will cost them additional money. What is ABC's responsibility to XYZ? Well, let's discuss the last consideration. If it costs additional, no doubt that XYZ has to pay the additional expense, out-of-pocket expense. They also have to pay the expense of the time used by its employees to chase these individuals down. Otherwise, ABC has no responsibility whatsoever. On the other hand, the first two considerations have to be judged much more carefully and specifically in each case. Assuming it's never happened before, which is the implication of the question, the fear that it's not professional, make them look bad, they're incompetent, is somewhat mitigated. Mistakes, everyone makes mistakes. If they are regular customers, these three customers, and they've been dealing with ABC for years, frankly, they should have called up ABC and say, how come my check hasn't cleared, if they're honest people? Okay, they don't look at the checks too carefully, or maybe they're hoping that they'll get away with it, as the case may be. They understand this is an exception, that they've done business with ABC over many years. It's never happened before, and it'll likely never happen again. And therefore, I think ABC can contact them. said, hi, regular customers. Well, then ABC has very little to lose by contacting them either. You're afraid that they're going to be Motsi Shemra on ABC? It's unlikely. They feel better things to do with their time. Therefore, it seems to me that ABC should try to get new checks issued after they, of course, return the old checks, whose time has passed. No one wants to give a new check without getting the old check back. If ABC refuses, I guess they have to go to a dentara to work it out. Question 6. Again, BH, we are doing renovations to our shul, including the Aron Kodesh. What should be done with the old materials from the Aron Kodesh? If it requires Geniza, which materials should be buried? Which materials are considered Tashmishe Kedusha? Would dismantling and burial require supervision? The big question over here is the Aron Kodesh Tashmishe Kedusha or not? The Machlokes, like many things, some say it's called Tashmish de Tashmish, which means that the Sefer Torah proper, the parchment, never touches the Aron Kodesh, the separation of the cover, known as the mantle. There's no din of Tashmish Kedusha. And a second reason given is that the primary role of the Aron Kodesh is what we call for Shmira, to protect it from thieves or from other types of damage. And for these reasons, if you look in Mishnah Berurah, Simakuf Nun Dalet, Sifkat Yud Dalet, on a simple level, it should not be a Tashmish Kedusha at all. It should be a Tashmish to Tashmish, or something made for Shmira, which does not have the same level of Kedusha. It's true, if you look at Sifkat and Tes, that same Simon talks about an Argaz, holding a Sefer Torah, that could be referring to a case where it's made only the covered, only for honor. It's not made to store it. But when they take the Sefer Torah out, they take it in that container. In that case, the minhag is to be strict, even though it doesn't touch, which is also hard to understand. Why shouldn't it be a tashmish? The tashmish. Who is lenient over here? The Bach and the Prisha and Yeridea. However, this is pointed out again in Piskei Tshuva, Kufnu Dalet footnote 54, and others, the Vilna Gaon and Simon Reish Pei Beis of Kodin Chav Ches is strict in this matter. And he explains that while the Gemara's case in Chavav and Megillah is referring to a Sefer Torah on a surface. So if there's an interruption, it's called Tashmish to Tashmish. Here, the Sefer Torah is not on, but in. Not on, but in. What's the difference, you'll ask? It's a good question. Rabbi Vadya, in Yabiyom HaChel HaKes Simen Yutes, cited in Piskei Tshuvos, says the same Chumah for the Rishon LeTzion, that's Aruch Chaim HaKadosh. Why? The Lashon is as follows, Lashon of the Gra. Quote, Ki ein manichin besocho l'olam b'li tiku mitachas. Afil hoch emin ad tashmishu. In other words, we know that an Aron Kodesh always has some kind of a covering, and nonetheless, it's still called a tashmish and not a tashmish de tashmish. I don't think it's a distinction so much of in or on, but rather, is it always used that way? So used that way only sometimes. On the other hand, we can interpret the Gra as is found in Yabiyoma from the Ben Ish Chai in Rav Polin, who says if it's in something and it's always in that something, then the two items somehow combine into one. The cover of the Sefer Torah and Aron Kodesh are like one. He calls like there's a concept of kiss betoch kiss. That apply to two kelim miyuchadim if they're always together. Of course, here not always together. You do take the Sefer Torah out of the Aron Kodesh whenever it's being read from. The Abiyoma rejects the Svar based on the Ramah there in Sivav, which says the Parochas is the Tashmish, even though the Parochas is always used in conjunction with the Aron Kodesh proper. The Kitzur, there are many Mekilim in the Shaila. Nonetheless, we try to be as respectful as we can. Even if it doesn't require Geniza proper, we should treat the items carefully with a measure of respect as much as possible. 7. Is one allowed to be a member of a JCC that is open on Shabbos? Not one answer to all cases. In some situations, it's been open on Shabbos for decades. Impossible to change it based upon the population of the community. In my opinion, in that case, it's permissible to join. Your joining does not mean you approve that it's open on Shabbos. You're joining because it's a reality. That's just the way it is. It always has been that way. And there's no possibility of changing it. Mostly in communities where the significant majority is non-observant. And it's just not in the cards to change it. On the other hand, if it was closed from before, either because there was a greater Orthodox population or because as an accommodation to the Orthodox, now they want to change it, as happened in certain communities, then that's a different story. Then participation in that JCC is giving them help when they don't deserve it, when they're trying to keep it open when it should be closed, either because it was closed or because now the population is becoming much more observant and they should be respectful of the majority which wants it closed. Again, it depends upon the rabbanim in town to decide whether this idea of not joining or renouncing membership is the proper way to go given the circumstances. Question number 8. A member wants to make a kiddush for his daughter in honor of her siyum on Mishnayos. This would certainly be a breach in our community. How should this be handled while, of course, taking the child's feelings into consideration as well? Is it mutter to announce in honor of her siyum without stating what it is? Of course, some will know what is going on, but many may not, in my assessment of the crowd. Others may see this nuance as non-approval without conflict, and others will view this as ridiculous. Well, people see things, view things in different ways. Take a step back. Can't compare every community one to another. It's a breach in our community. Now, if I understand it correctly, the breach in the community is that in the community under question, the girls are not learning Mishnayos, considered inappropriate, and therefore to make a siyum for something which is inappropriate would be a breach. I'm on record as saying that there's no iser formally of a woman learning Mishnayos. There are girls' schools where they learn Mishnayos, even where they don't learn Gemara. Apparently, in this community, they don't learn Mishnayos. If they don't learn Mishnayos, and it's a breach of the community, then it shouldn't be done. The father should be told privately in his house. Do not believe it's proper to make a kiddush over an event which is considered a breach in the particular community. Having said that, there are different communities where a breach is a breach and offense, you know, pour it together. Together is found in many different places in many different communities. It's not just a matter of women learning Mishnayos. There are many other manifestations of women's practices and general practices where the fence is in one place here and another place there. Where it constitutes a breach, it should not be allowed. Certainly not, should not be celebrated with a kiddush for the whole shul. And that's why I think in this particular case, as it's described, the person should be told to make a kiddush privately. This issue, as I guess many people on the call are aware, it's been a very controversial one over the last period of time. Myself was involved in something somewhat controversial about 6 months ago, which I think is, Baruch Hashem, is replaced by other controversies. I haven't changed what I said then. I think what I said then was true. These policies concerning women with respect to Torah Shabbat Peh depend upon the time, the place, the circumstances. It was recently pointed out to me that whatever is found in the Shulchan Aruch as being as not to be done, even if it is what I called an Eitzah of Chachamim, Tibur Chachamim, and not an absolute prohibition, nonetheless, if you want to go against the Eitzah of the Tibur Chachamim, by definition, it requires reevaluation. Can it be something which is completely permanent because it's against the Shulchan Aruch? So I think that this is something which has to be carefully considered in each and every community. And again, in a particular community where it constitutes a breach, it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be started with the kiddush in the shul itself. Question number 9. Is it mutter to use SodaStream on Shabbos? I'm told it does not involve electricity. Completely correct. Is this Tikkun Mana? You know, the new edition of Shvira Shabbos Kilchasa is fundamentally the same as the previous one. However, there are updates in terms of new items or situations which came about between 1979 and 2010. That's a long period, that's over 30 years. And one of them, guess what? SodaStream. If you look in the Shmir Shabbos Kachasta, in the new edition, Perek Yud Aleph, Sif Lamed Vov, he mentions SodaStream by name, something he couldn't have done back in 1979. He says, Bakbuke SodaStream. He says it's permissible to introduce the combination on Shabbos. A lengthy footnote of Shlomo Zalman. He was referring most to the older manifestations. But he says that there's no prohibition in carbonating water. Some say carbonating water is like matake and mana. You're making the water better. Or some things like cooking the water. All this is rejected. He quotes from Rabbi Avadia, who also has two tshuvas about it, Chelek Gimel, Simon Chafalef, and Chelek Dalet, Simon Lamed Beis, in response to Lamed Aleph, which is Rav Waldenberg's response to his earlier tshuva. And Rabbi Avadia said it's not considered to be making carbonation. That's not a problem. The fact that you're tightening the top of the bottle, you do that all the time. It was screwing on and off bottles. And since you're going to remove the bottle cap after you fill it and you carbonate it, I consider it to be a problem, even though it's what's called havraga. It's some kind of a screw-on cover that SodaStream uses. It's a question whether it's comparable to something which the Chazanish said about electricity. Shlomo Zalman is makel. He points out that the custom is to screw and unscrew the top of a baby bottle. Is of this nature not comparable to what's called Mita Shel Tarsi and Makana Shel Sayodin on Shabbos on Mem Zayin? They're making a kli from new. Here it's just called usage, not called making something anew. So therefore, I seem that think that SodaStream is permissible. Question number 10. What criteria in mental health disorders determine a person being considered a chole, that he or she should be added to a mishaberach list? Are diagnoses such as OCD, bipolar depression, etc. be considered for Shini Hashem? Neither mishaberach list nor Shini Hashem are halachic categories. You can put a person on or off mishaberach list at will, and you can change your name at will as well. So it's hard for me to respond to these questions in their present form, because you can do what you want. So how appropriate it is, both in terms of Mishaberach and Shini Hashem, would be the Rav's discretion in every situation. It is relevant in halachic terms whether a lien is for a kol she'ein bo sakana. Obviously, if there's a sakana involved, Berach and even for Shini Hashem. But if there's not, these three individuals, OCD, bipolar, or depressed, can be considered a chole she'ein bo sakana, where we can put Mechal Shabbos to a goy, for example. The general rule is, if it can't function normally, is included in this category. The most famous example, someone who was limited to his bed, Nachal Mishkov. This is found in the Ramah and Simon Shin Chav Ches. But there's a more general definition. It cannot function normally. It's really found in the classical Poskim as well. And in Mara Makomas and Shemir Shabbos, Perek Lama Gimel, Sif Aleph, Section Hey, and Ha'ar Ches, and Section Ches. And in Perek Lama Zion, base and footnote Dalit, the same impression is conveyed with respect to Chola Shein Bo Sakana in general. Someone who cannot function normally, it includes a child that's not so independent. Every case is different. All these things are spectrums. Some OCDs and bipolars and depressed manage quite well on their own. They're able to function normally as a rule. And therefore, then, when they're okay, there'd be no heter of using a goy to do something to help them out with the malacha. If they're in bad shape, not functioning as the Shmir Shabbos was called, the Kol Adam, like an average person who was able to function, then there's room to consider them a chola, shein bo sakana, according to halacha, and ask a goy to do malacha on Shabbos and other things as well. Number 11. A woman in my shul recently came across her parents' ksuba and discovered that her father's Hebrew name, as it appeared on his ksuba, is different from what she had always taken her father's name to be, based on what everyone always called him, including as he was called for aliyahs to the Torah. Her father was not from, but she is certain that the officiating rabbi would have sought out her father's real Hebrew name. There's further evidence in the fact that her father's name appears on the ksuba as Eliezer, while they always heard him referred to as Lover, which sounds, she always found strange. Does she require a new ksuba for herself to list her father's name as it apparently appears on his own ksuba? In other words, she was called in a ksuba Sarah Bas Lovan. She wants to change it to Sarah Bas Eliezer. The fact that past tense is being used here to me indicates that the father is no longer with us. Otherwise, she would ask him more details. And if it's possible that the name Eliezer, although it was found in the Ksuba, which was recently discovered, Ksuba was hidden away for 50 years, and no one ever called him Eliezer since then, there's a concept of a shem shenishtaka, something which is forgotten and which is literally sunk into oblivion. And therefore, maybe his Hebrew name for the last 50 years really was Lavan, believe it or not, as strange as it sounds. And even if she decides, this is ridiculous, henceforth, asking my father's name, I want to make some kind of a, you know, Misha Berach for the family, they'll call me from now on Sarabas Eliezer, the Ksuba might still be kosher. Because in real time, when it was written, her name was Sarabas Lovan. And her father was known that way. It wasn't a mistake. That's what he was known at the time. this is often the custom if someone has a father who's unfortunately sick and they add another name. So she got married 30 years ago when her father was 50, and she was called Sarah Bas Eliezer. Now, father got sick, he's now called Chaim Eliezer. He has 10 kids. They have to all run to the Sefer to get a new ksuba. Most people don't do that. The reason is, it wasn't the toast. At the time, his name was Eliezer. She was known as Sarah Bas Eliezer, and her brother's known as Reuben Ben Eliezer. If a person wants to run to a Sefer and then write a new ksuba and call it the Shtak Rabbi Tausa, it's not really a toast. It's just not consistent with present identification. It's permissible, but I don't think it's necessary. Number 12. What's the deal with regarding lining a crock pot with aluminum foil to avoid issues of shahiyah? Being that the purpose of leaving coals goruf or kutum is as a heker, that one is no longer interested in using the coals, would it be necessary to actively re-line the crock pot with foil each week? Or can the previous week's lining be relied upon even as a heker for this Shabbos? Good question. The custom is to be lenient in this matter. Since in the rest of the world, the crock pot is used without any lining, the fact that there's a lining in this person's crock pot, differing from the custom throughout the rest of the world, is in and of itself a heker for Shomer Shabbos from week to week. You don't have to change the foil each week. On the other hand, you have to make sure that it's a proper heker. In a typical crock pot, the proper heker has to be something which is visible when a person walks into the kitchen and sees the crock pot on the counter. If the lining does not rise up visibly above the outer container, it's useless as a heker. You have to make sure that it extends in a very visible fashion over the rim, if you will, so it can be seen and serve as a heker. Of course, the only need for a heker, according to Ashkenazi, will follow the Ramah, is in the case in which the food in the crock pot was not cooked k'macha ben dusoi, which for Ashkenaz means one third of it's been cooked, some say half. Then there is an Easter of Shehiyah if it's not covered. In most cases, most cholins, I think, are even more than half cooked when Shabbos comes in, again, generally speaking, in which case there is no requirement of Gruf or Ketuma. It would have to cover it in the first place. I should add, although it's not part of the question technically, that the question was correct in limiting his question to Shehiyah. But as far as Hachzara is concerned, putting a pot which it took off the fire, put it back inside the crock pot, in my opinion, is not allowed. That's called Hachzara Litocha, which the Gemara explicitly prohibits in the Masechta Shabbos, Aflam and Zayin, Amud Aleph. It's found in Shulchan Aruch here in Reishon and Gimel as well. So there are some who disagree, but I thought that's the proper Pesach LaHaloch. Finally, question 13. A burial society that owns couples' rows and singles' rows for men and women buried a husband in a couples' row. The wife was naturally given a reservation next to her husband. Society's policy is to bill the Avel the week after Shiva for all burial and grave expenses and to not burden the Avelim. And they receive payment for the husband's grave and expenses and a letter reserving the other grave for her. It is 23 years later. The wife is not well. Her request is to not be buried next to her husband but in a single row for women. So what's behind that? The burial society feels that they should charge the family twice now to protect themselves, that they will lose the grave of the spot they put the spot next to the husband, since they could not put another woman there. If they put a man, he will be next to a non-related woman on his other side. The family certainly does not want to pay these double fees. What is the right thing to do here? Can someone other than a wife or blood relative be buried next to her husband in a couple's row? So here we discuss strict halacha and custom. Strict halacha is no problem. Anyone can be buried next to anyone. But this burial society clearly has a different custom, and they are insisting that you don't have a man buried next to a, we'll call it a strange woman. Okay, that's the custom. They should adhere to the custom. And therefore, there's very little choice for the family. If their mother wants to be buried in a different row, women only, they have to reimburse the cemetery because this plot is going to be remain unusable forever. The only alternative, as the questioner implied at the end of the last line, that a different blood relative could be buried next to the husband. Sometimes it could be an older single daughter that may need a burial plot, could be buried next to her father. You know, so if they in fact pay for this extra grave, they still have the right to use it as long as the usage does not contradict the policies of the burial society. It's not clear from the question who owns the next two graves. If they are not spoken for, you know, another option could be to buy two more graves and figure out how we can maintain the policy. Either put four men in a row, or you have some other combination of where blood relatives are near each other. Otherwise, it cannot be done, and the family that reserved the grave 23 years ago has a responsibility to pay for that grave upon its being used, because otherwise it simply cannot be used in a couple's row. We'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. We hope we can call upon you again in a few weeks.
Mir tashem.
Thank you. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.